This is Sarah Weddington welcoming you to the Texas Tribune Tribcast. One saying that I live by is, seek out things that bring you joy. And many experiences have brought me joy. For example, being the first woman elected from Austin Travis County to the Texas Legislature, being the youngest person to win a case in the U.S. Supreme Court, being assistant to the President of the United States under Jimmy Carter. And now, here's a modern media miracle who brings knowledge and joy. Here is your host, Reeve Hamilton.
Thank you, Dr. Weddington. This is reporter Reeve Hamilton here with the Tribcast for the third week of January. Joining me is executive editor Ross Ramsey.
Howdy.
Managing editor Brandy Grissom.
Hola.
And reporter Tan Tan.
Hello.
Thank you all for joining us this week.
Oh, now you're in us?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Here we go.
That's right. We're going to be talking about the end of a lot of things. The potential end of Rick Perry's campaign, the end of many lives of prisoners over the course of the years, and what, the potential end of women's
health
care.
Who writes your stuff? This is unbelievable.
This is all at the top of my head.
Shocking.
Should we start with the South Carolina primary that's coming up on Saturday? Ross, what are we expecting to happen?
I think we're, you know, everybody's sort of doing their pre-bituaries on Rick Perry right now. It doesn't look like, unless a miracle happens, that he's going to get the kind of win that would put him back in the running here.
What kind of win would that be?
Well, they're heading into a state, you know, that costs, you know, $4 to $8 million to run a primary, and this is Florida, on the 31st of January. So he would have to have a win significant enough in South Carolina for all the money people to look up and go, whoo, we were wrong. We need to put some money into that guy and give him the financial steam to go into Florida. And barring a win that just, you know, unless he beats Romney or really, really performs here or some political miracle happens, I don't see that. I think Saturday's the end of it.
And that, nothing has happened in the last few days to make anyone think that a miracle's on the way, right?
Well, I thought he did okay in the debate on Monday, the Fox debate. He didn't really have any, well, he had a couple flubs,
yeah.
What am I saying?
He didn't have anything other than that, like, international incident he caused.
Well, but he did bring attention to Mitt Romney's issue of releasing his tax return, so that's been on the radar. So, you know, he succeeded in getting that out there. But I think he's had too many blows rather than any momentum. You know, I mean, the group of evangelicals who met here in Texas in his home state who supported his revival last summer,
right,
came out and said, we're going to support Santorum instead of Rick Perry because he's had too many goofs and gaffes. That's pretty embarrassing.
Well, he's not talking to undecided voters anymore. He's talking to people who've already made a decision about him. And first he has to move them off of the decision into undecided and then has to move them from undecided to him. And he's not given them any reasons to do that.
Well, in the international incident, just to provide some context for that comment, was
you thought he, I was going to do your footnote for
yeah,
you
yeah I was hoping
you?
So I don't like to work on these things at all. I don't know if anyone's noticed, but he basically said that Turkey, one of our key allies in that part of the world, was run by Islamic terrorists. And the Turkish government did not take kindly to that, so I think that could be considered a flub.
Yeah, that's a goof.
Brandy,
that's a goof.
I just think it's interesting that we sort of consider a debate where he only makes one minor international incident a good debate for him. I think that says a lot about sort of where he is in the campaign and how far he hasn't come from the beginning.
This is just anecdotal, but I was following the Twitter feeds, you know, during the debate, and there were a lot of analysts who were saying, what if this Rick Perry had showed up 3 months ago? There's a lot of what ifs.
But I also wonder if, getting to the tax return thing, if at some point he brought in this new team that threw out this playbook, and obviously at that point he was already sort of, not doing that well. He was sort of treading water.
Right.
But it does seem that maybe his original playbook in terms of messaging might have been a more effective one, which is the old demand tax returns from your opponents and just hype jobs in the economy, rather than go off on these weird religious tangents.
And don't debate.
Right, right. Well, I mean, you know, he pulled...
Don't debate, definitely.
Every time he's had a rich opponent, he's pulled the tax return thing out. He did it with Bill White in the 2010 gubernatorial race. He did it against Tony Sanchez in the 2002 gubernatorial race. You know, it's one of his standard tricks. Actually, I thought the Turkish terrorist thing was the sort of thing that he was most in danger on when he first started talking about this. You know, you look at a Texas governor... And, you know, remember back in the day when he checked all of those boxes? It's like he's conservative, he's fiscally conservative, social conservative, Tea Party, da-da-da-da-da-da. And then you get to foreign policy and you go, this guy didn't know anything about foreign policy. That's where he's going to make a mistake. You know, that's, you know, it made sense. When you get to a debate and it's about Poland or something, he's going to be in trouble. And here he is, all of the other stuff aside. You know, if this had been the guy that showed up 3 months ago, that's the story we would have been talking about. Oh, this guy didn't have any foreign policy experience.
Right, but I mean, you could probably in a debate, there's a way to skirt around that without making such a strong argument against a country. Or maybe, I mean, maybe that's how he really feels about Turkey, and he's sort of standing up, and he's the only one saying it.
They defended it. I mean, they've stood their ground on it. They haven't run away from that comment.
I think what's interesting, too, in this whole debate about Rick Perry, this being possibly the end of his campaign this weekend, is looking at the other Texan in the race, and we've discussed this behind the scenes here at the Tribune, you know, about Ron Paul and how well he's doing compared to Rick Perry. And when this all began, I think we all thought he wasn't going to get anywhere. You know, I mean, Rick Perry was the mainstream Republican who was going to possibly be the candidate or be the nominee. And now Ron Paul has been doing very well. He's raising a lot of money. And I think he's surprising a lot of people in the establishment in a bad way where they don't know what to do with him.
Well, if he finished first, then I think the headlines would be Romney second, Gingrich third. You know, Paul just can't buy a break here. And part of it is because he's always capped out, you know, and he's capping out, or he's, you know, he's doing better in this race than he did in 2008 or 1988. But he's always sort of the 7% solution. You know, he starts at 7, he ends at 7 and out. You know, and
but it seems like maybe his cap is higher than some people expected.
But this time, yeah, he's kind of, you know, there's like, you know, the standard narrative here is you've got Romney and the not Romneys, and Paul's not really one of the not Romneys. It's more like Romney, the not Romneys, and Paul. And kind of look at this, and you know, you can look at this and say, it may be that we get to the convention and that Romney's clearly the nominee, and Ron Paul's still in there, plugging away with, you know, one out of five Republicans.
Well, Tom, you were there in New Hampshire for his New Hampshire win. What was the vibe like around his campaign?
Well, I think what's interesting is the
I said his New Hampshire win. I meant his New Hampshire second place finish.
He considered it a victory.
That's more than a ticket to ride,
obviously.
Though.
Well,
to
they wanted to be in a solid second place. They got that solid second place. And what I notice is that, you know, the people that he attracts, they're not just Republicans, but they're also Democrats and independents who have said they will not vote for Mitt Romney if he's a Republican nominee. So he brings in this very unique, you know, interesting crossover crowd of voters. And I think that, you know, I mean, this isn't even about so much for him. I think he knows that he's probably not going to win the nomination, but it's very much about getting that message out there. I mean, this is a guy who Ross, you've been here in Texas longer than I have, but for years and years and years, this guy's been saying the same thing. We need to change our monetary policy. We need to not get involved in international conflicts. And that message is resonating with a lot more people now. So I think, you know, I think that for him, this is about staying in the race as long as possible, continuing to raise money, and trying to bring as much attention to that platform as possible to try to influence the Republican
Party. So when they have the convention, they basically have to use his ideas and implement them in order to maintain their coalition.
Well, I don't know. I don't know that they're actually going to pick up the idea. I mean, it is interesting, though, and I think you're onto something. But, you know, the thing with Paul is if somebody is in the Paul camp, you know, that's a Democrat or an independent, is their second choice Obama before Romney? I mean, that's kind of an interesting thing. The other deal is how many of them are with Paul just because they don't like, you know, the flavors of the week? It's sort of the middle finger primary here. It's like, you know, I don't like Obama. I don't like Romney. Unlike any of you professional people, I like that guy just because he's different and he's an outsider and he's,
yeah,
you know,
he sort of transcends politics in a way, you know, because it's not, I mean, there are people who will agree with him on one point and completely disagree with him on another. But what they like is they say this is a guy who's at least authentic and honest and consistent.
But that's why he can't close. I think that's his problem.
True.
I think everybody kind of goes, wow, that's, you know, that's refreshing to hear that. You know, that guy gives a good speech. I really like what he was saying. I believed him when he said he would if he wasn't debating on a Saturday night, he'd be reading an economics textbook.
I think his popularity sort of says more about the field of candidates that are available to choose from than it does about maybe what the voting public is looking for.
Mm-hmm. Well, can I also ask about his relationship with the media? You know, we used to hear all of these, you know, sort of stories. There were tons of stories about how no one was covering him.
Right.
And now the latest headlines, he keeps making headlines for walking out of interviews. His campaigns are yelling at reporters. You know, there was that thing with Dana Bash. I think you were around for that, right, Ton?
Yeah.
Where Dana Bash was basically asking him, sort of relaying a concern of a voter, and his campaign just starts shouting at her. You know, and I've tried to coordinate stuff with the Paul campaign. They're incredibly hard to, you know, work with, honestly.
They really want to control their message, I mean, I think, for one thing. But I think also, I mean, Ron Paul, what I noticed in New Hampshire, and just I followed him, you know, several different places for a few days, and he loves to talk about the message. He hates talking about himself, and he hates talking. He likes certain questions that have to do with policy. He doesn't like to talk about, you know, I mean, what happened in New Hampshire was he went to a restaurant, was looking to have breakfast. The media was invited. Too many people from the media came. They couldn't even sit down. So he decided, forget this. I can't say anything. I'm leaving. And people were upset because voters were like, we wanted you to sit down and talk with us. And he didn't do that. So I don't know. I just feel like he's not, unlike other candidates who love attention, who love to get on air whenever they possibly can, who love to be, you know, have photos snapped of them when they're eating popsicles and sausage sticks or whatever. He's not really like that, you know? And I think that, and he was asked about this and he wasn't happy about
that. The old sausage stick loving politicians.
Yeah.
Well, he didn't, you know, he doesn't like the media when they're not covering him. And then when they do cover him, he thinks they're stupid.
Yeah, just that, you know, sort of having your cake and eating
well,
it too, isn't
but,
it?
But, you know, think about this. That's kind of on message here. That's, you know, I'm an outsider. These people aren't running this right. The politicians aren't doing it right. The mainstream media is not doing it right. Only we can do it right. If you look at their financials and look at how candidates are doing with financials, it's like everybody else is on this hero goat roller coaster. You had a good week, and so you raise a bunch of money. You had a bad week, and you don't raise any. And Paul is like steady stream of money coming in. There's a steady internet coming in, steady internet feed coming in. It's like he's running a primary that the rest of them aren't involved in.
Right. Mm-hmm. The hero goat amusement
park.
Well,
he's just—he's on the—I mean, he's got, you know, his followers are kind of in there, slow and steady. He always has about $7 to $10 million available. Click, click, click. You know,
and so he's, as we've said before, he's not going anywhere.
I think he's a factor in this thing.
I meant he's not dropping out anytime. I mean, he'll be in there
well,
to
right,
the end.
Right, right. I thought you were, he wasn't.
No, he's. Him. I mean, he's made clear he's focusing on the caucus states. So.
Right. Right. When this gets down to, you know, we're in the second 25 states, and it's not exciting anymore. You know, we're tired of, you know, Iowa and New Hampshire and all of those kinds of places, and we're into, you know, the mash of other states, and it's just down to Romney and somebody else. That's going to be Paul.
One thing I wonder that I haven't heard about a lot is, back when McCain was running, we heard a lot about his age and sort of his health and those issues. You know, Ron Paul is older.
He was asked about that in New Hampshire during one of the rare availabilities to the media, and I think a reporter from the Concord Monitor was like, everybody's kind of wondering, you're 76 years old, how are you holding up on the campaign trail? And he said that, you know, he's like, look, I don't get to work out as much as I usually do, but he's very adamant about going on morning walks, and he's very adamant about going on an afternoon bike ride, especially when
he's
back
Mr. Bicycle,
in Texas.
Isn't he? Yeah.
Apparently he is, and, you know, he's been criticized because he takes time off after each of these, you know, after Iowa and after New Hampshire, he came back here to Texas to spend time, quote, with his family. And people have said, that means this guy's not serious. But I also think that's just his way of, he's resting. You know, he's taking the time that he needs to regather his energy before he gets out on the campaign trail.
Betty White just had her 90th birthday on NBC or whatever channel she's on. She's older than him. She's doing okay, it seems like.
Maybe
she
could be his running mate.
She's running sixth in South Carolina.
Yeah,
right?
That's right. Yeah, she's just ahead of Rick Perry in South Carolina. Yeah, I don't know. I think probably, why didn't he just say, you know, well, no one actually expects me to win this thing. You know, it's not a real concern.
I he said I'm in good health, basically, right? And, you know, he seems to be in pretty good health.
He seems to be in good health. Well, speaking of people that are not in good health, I guess, there's
another
no way to
transition
not...
brought to you by Rick Hamill.
There's no way to make a non-crass transition. Things coming to an end. Well, I guess, should we just...
it's already crass. I think it's already...
Yeah.
Yeah,
do we think the Perry campaign is for sure coming to an end after South Carolina?
I think that if they are not coming to an end in South Carolina, then we'll be writing about a political miracle on Sunday and Monday.
All right.
Or we'll either be writing about a political miracle, or we'll be writing about, denial's not just a river in Egypt.
Yeah, sort of another... He's what is he going to tweet on Sunday
morning? I'm
going
to wait for him to go on that morning after jog, and we'll see.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
All right, well, now that our crass transition was already made, I guess we'll just move on to the... Brandy, you'd had a story on the anniversary of the death penalty sort of kicking back into high gear here in the state. What were the numbers you found, and what are the highlights? Highlights is another bad word. Lowlights.
You should shut up.
Say, Brandy, death penalty,
Brandy, take over.
So the deal is that yesterday was the 35th anniversary of the reinstatement of the death penalty.
Yesterday is Tuesday.
That's correct. And so what had happened was there was a moratorium on the death penalty nationwide after the Supreme Court said that the states were implementing the death penalty in a way that was arbitrary and capricious. And then back in 1977, they restarted the death penalty when Utah used the firing squad to execute Gary Gilmore. And then shortly after that, in 1982, Texas took off with its death penalty. And as we all know, it's now and has been for some time the state with more executions than any other in the nation. And so what Ryan Murphy and I did was took a look at all the data that TDCJ has compiled over the years of the death penalty here. And we looked at just straight numbers. How many executions have there been? How many people are there on death row? What's the racial breakdown of the people who have been executed and the people who remain on death row? And so, you know, we found some pretty interesting things. Altogether, there have been 477 executions in Texas since the reinstatement of the death penalty, which is about 300 more than our nearest competitor state.
Wow.
Yeah.
Because honestly, I thought that 477 sort of didn't sound like a lot to me. But not in terms of, like, I just mean in terms of what the...
you thought it would be more?
What the stereotype of Texas is just this trigger-happy, you know, send everyone to the chair kind of state.
Well, there have been periods of relative, you know, where this was in relative disuse, right? I mean, there were, even since 77, there were years when, you know, there weren't so many executions, and then there have been years when there were a lot. Is that right? Or has it been pretty steady?
Well, so it's been on a real steady incline. It was on a real steady incline from 1982 until about 1999, when there was a real peak, and there were like 130-some executions that year. And then after that, it really started to come down, and I think what you see sort of timing related there is that's when we really started to see the increase in the use of DNA. We started to see more exonerations, and in Texas we also saw the implementation of life without parole, which I think was a big deterrent for juries in deciding to mete out the death penalty.
Mm-hmm. But Brandy, and the bottom line is, it doesn't seem like, unlike other states like Illinois that have had second thoughts about what to do about the death penalty, there is no way that policy-wise that the state of Texas is going to have any kind of a moratorium or, you know, second thoughts about the death penalty.
No. I mean, Texans in particular are very adamant about the use of the death penalty. They feel like it's a big deterrent, and, you know, it's sort of, Texas motto.
We've polled this question before. I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but I do remember that last time we polled it, that the Texas electorate was strongly for the death penalty, and it didn't matter if they were Republican, Democratic, you know, what their demographics were. They were all for it.
Here's that polling data. It says that the death penalty remains popular in Texas. 49% say they strongly support it. Another 25% say they somewhat support it. And only 21% oppose it. 12% say strongly. And then what's super interesting about this polling question was when people were asked, are there wrongly convicted people in Texas, one-third answered never or almost never, but 41 answered occasionally, and 15% answered a great deal of the time. So people are basically saying, you know, we think we almost get it right all the time, but we think the death penalty is okay.
Yeah, most of the time it's okay, but we support it, right?
Yeah.
The thing that's killed it in other states, or that's been a hindrance to it in other states, has been the idea that, or the argument that has worked for death penalty opponents in other states, has been, even if you support the death penalty, do you think it's fairly administered? Which is where we were going with that question. And in Texas, apparently, it's like, well, we think it's fairly administered most of the time, and we're for it.
But we still don't have the, I guess that's why the Cameron Todd Willingham case is so bad, because we still don't have the proven case of someone that has been executed that was wrongfully convicted.
Right. Yeah. I mean,
the Willingham case is in question. I mean,
there's still question there, but, you know, Anthony Graves was on death row.
Right. And but he wasn't executed. I mean, people that, you know, support it can say, well, the system worked, we got him out. Right.
Right. Which is what Governor Perry has said.
Right.
You know, one other thing that I thought was kind of fascinating in this data was that, you know, I guess when we look back to why the death penalty was originally stopped, it was largely because there were arguments about how race factored into it, and that more black people were being...
this is what Ron Paul said at the debate a couple debates ago, right? When he was being asked about his newsletters, his defense was his newsletters, which has all these racially tinged stuff from back in 1990 or whatever. And he was like, I can't be racist. I'm the only one up here that appreciates the inherent racism in our criminal justice system.
Hmm. I mean, that's certainly what the argument was and why the Supreme – one of the reasons it contributed to the Supreme Court stopping it back in the 70s. And so I was looking at this data, and it shows that, you know, from the reinstatement of the death penalty up until, you know, the last couple of years, the number of black people put to death compared to the number of Hispanic people was pretty well, like, yeah, significant number of black people more than Hispanic people. But in the last couple of years, that trend has started to reverse, and there are more Hispanic people who are being executed than black people. And in fact, the first person who's set to be executed here later this month is a Hispanic guy from San Antonio. So, I mean, I guess that's also just a change in our demographics, but I think it's something interesting to see in the numbers.
What about white people?
Well, the number of white people has stayed pretty steady comparatively.
But the numbers are out of proportion with the population, right?
Yeah. Actually, last couple of years, there have been more white people than Hispanic or black people.
Well, just generally, Texas juries are handing out fewer death sentences, I mean, significantly than at least a decade ago, right?
Absolutely. The last couple of years, they've been lower than any time in the last decade. So
as much as they may support it in polling, it seems like they're slowing their role on that.
This might be past what the data you had tells you, but how much of that's Harris County?
I mean, that was super interesting, right?
So Harris County used to be in front of most of the states and a bunch of countries all by itself.
Out of the 300 people on death row now, 104 of them are from Harris County.
Right.
Out of the 477 people executed, 116 of them were from Harris County.
Mm-hmm.
So Harris County accounts for a huge number compared to the other counties of people who both have been executed and who are on death row.
Huh.
Was there a big push to reinstate the death penalty in Texas in the 80s? Well, I mean, it was just like, well, Utah's doing it, we might as well get back into this game.
Well, I mean, some of it was, you know, this is driven to some extent, I think, by local prosecutors. And, you know, one of the hardest jobs to get to knock somebody out of in Texas is a district attorney. And district attorneys, you know, run to some extent, you know, certainly in Dallas during that period and in Harris County during that period and some of the big counties on their ability to fight crime. And one of the leading statistics in that is, you know, capital murder cases. So, you know, Johnny B. Holmes in Harris County and initially, I guess, Henry Wade in Dallas County and some others were, you know, this was sort of their political bread and butter, which is one of the questions about the death penalty and whether it's a conflict of interest because it's such a political boon to whoever's administering it.
I think one of the other issues that came up back during that time was there was also, they had, I'm going to mess up some of the details, but there was an issue with a lot of people being released on parole because prisons were overcrowded.
Right.
And one of those people who was released was a sort of infamous, someone who ended up being an infamous serial killer.
A repeat offender.
Yeah. And so that contributed a great deal to this sort of tough on crime attitude, and we're not going to let people out so that they can commit these kinds of heinous crimes again.
Right. Any predictions for the 30th anniversary then? Will we still be having the sort of the same conversation then?
Yeah.
I don't see anything in the numbers that says this is going to change in Texas right now.
I mean, we'll probably be looking at a smaller number of contributions to that overall number over the next several years. I mean, last couple of years I've only seen like 13 executions apiece or something like that. So certainly the numbers are going down, but I don't think it's stopping.
If we already have a 300-person head start, I mean, that is pretty significant.
California has their death row is twice the size of ours, but they don't ever execute anybody.
Right. That's amounted to a life sentence.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that?
Because their appellate system is bizarre.
Because they're Californians.
A lot about that state is a... Well, Tan, we're going to move over to your story now. Thank you, Brandy, for running us through that.
Sure. Anytime I can provide a little sunshine in your life.
Right. We always bring Brandy in when things are getting too rosy outside.
So my topic's pretty depressing, too, though. I don't know.
That's true.
Mm. What is your topic?
Well, this week we got some new information from Department of State Health Services. And the overall picture is we're still learning the effects of the budget cuts that were made during the last legislative session. So last September, women's health, as people may or may not recall, was gutted by two-thirds. So from like $111 million down to $30-some million for all you know, state contractors. So last September, the first stage of cuts was made, and they, you know, cut 15 providers. So it was down to like 56 state contractors around the state, way less money. Well, this month, they have released a new list of contractors. They've reduced it even more. So now it's gone down to about 41 state family planning contractors around Texas, and they're dealing with a lot less money, only about $12 million for the next 14 months, I think. 14 months. And what's notable is that, you know, Governor Perry has gone around on the campaign trail, and a lot of anti-abortion folks in the legislature have said that, you know, they wanted to defund Planned Parenthood, and largely they have. There are no Planned Parenthood clinics or chapters that are in the under the list, you know, of contractors right now
that are funded by the state.
But, you know, because there are certain areas of the state where no one else applied for funding, they had to basically extend and give money to three Planned Parenthood chapters in along the border in North Texas and in Central Texas. It's only temporary, and what the state is doing is they're saying, we're going to reopen the proposal period here and try to get the word out more so that community clinics and FQHCs, federally qualified health centers, are aware that we still have another $2 million that we can give.
What medical services are we talking about?
We're talking about family planning, which would be STD testing, would be cancer screenings, breast cancer, cervical cancer, not abortions.
Right.
Non-abortion services. And in some cases, diabetes testing, well woman exam. Some women seek out sterilization. So the services kind of range. But, you know, I mean, I just think that it's also important to note that this is mostly, the vast majority of this money is federal money. The state, though, is assigned to basically appropriate that money. The Department of State Health Services has to decide how they're going to allocate those funds. So, you know, Planned Parenthood is basically, for instance, here in Austin, they've said they're just going to have to rely more on private donors to help them out so that they can try to fill the need and continue to provide low cost or, you know, free services to poor men and women. But, you know, even the remaining money, a lot of legislators were saying, well, we just diverted the funds. So, you know, we're taking money away from Planned Parenthood, but it's going to be able to go to community clinics and to FQHCs, which offer more comprehensive care to women. But that's actually not true. For instance, you know, I talked to the Lone Star Circle of Care clinics, you know, here in Central Texas, and they're saying, last year, you know, for instance, the state gave us enough federal funding so that we could pay for 70 to 80% of the cost of our family planning services. Under the new budget that they just got, they can only cover about 20%. So they have no idea. It's too early to know whether how many people they're actually going to turn away, but they know they don't have enough money to cover the cost.
Well, that was my question. I mean, do they have a state aggregate number where they can say, you know, this many people were served, this many people will be served? Or do they maintain that they'll keep the services to the same number of people, but just in fewer centers?
DSHS says that they've confirmed that, you know, the program itself has, the money has usually served about 220,000 women, mostly women, you know, per year. Under the new guidelines, about 180,000 people will be affected. But they're thinking, they've crunched the numbers, and as of today, they're estimating that, you know, from that 220,000, they're thinking that about 60,000 people will still be able to get services for the next year.
So where do the other 60-some thousand people go?
Nobody knows. I mean, that's the big, that's the unknown question. Nobody knows.
Emergency rooms?
Perhaps. Or they're they don't have it. Or, I mean, this is why, you know, LBB, which is the budget service, you know, for the legislature, warned lawmakers and said, if you cut this funding, we're looking at, you know, 20,000 plus extra babies that are going to be born under the Medicaid program. So
I had a fiscal note on a bill a few years ago. It was I don't remember the exact bill number, but I remember that it was a Warren Chisholm bill. And they basically came out with a fiscal note that said, if you cut these services, then this will happen, and then this will happen, and then that will happen. And the bottom line was that you'll have more babies. This percentage of babies in Texas who are born into the Medicaid program. That program costs this much per kid. If you make this many more kids, then you're going to have this many more costs. And here's the price tag. And the price tag was astronomical. Chisholm at the time said, well, you know, I'm pro-life, and this is worth it to me. But as a fiscal matter, you know, when the state looks at it, you know, it's it's obviously a pro-life, pro-choice issue to a lot of people, but it's also a fiscal issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, so and if anyone has seen state demographer Steve Murdoch, former state demographer Steve Murdoch's presentations that he does around the state, you know, we're already sort of a young state with a wave of young people coming through the pipeline that's going to cause all sorts of problems for public ed, higher ed, workforce capacity.
I think we'll just have to wait and see. Are these community health centers, are these Planned Parenthood chapters going to be able to somehow make up for the money that they've lost that they used to get from the state? I mean, that's really what it comes down to, because they're not willing to say, we are going to turn people away. They're saying, it's still too soon, it's too early, we don't know. So they're sort of delaying, you know, I mean, what the outcome of this could be. But they're going to try, you know,
well,
to
continue. It's not even all a Planned Parenthood thing. I mean, you know, a lot of the question is, what do the people who are being served now who wouldn't be served, what do they do for health services? You know, regardless of who's providing, I mean, where do they go for this kind of stuff? And what are the consequences of that?
Well, and maybe having an influx of 20,000 babies is something that Texas voters are fine with. You know, going out with the governor's campaign in Iowa, defunding Planned Parenthood is a huge applause line for him. You know, I don't know if it obviously didn't sway enough voters to caucus for him in that state.
Well, nobody was campaigning on the other side of that in a Republican primary.
Right.
I mean, there wasn't a...
But I mean, it's,
else,
you know, people are, there are people out there that are very happy with the defunding of Planned Parenthood.
Well, as I recall, during a press conference during one of these, it was either for the sonogram or I think it was the signing of the sonogram bill. I think, is it Senator Patrick? Is he the one? Dan Patrick?
Mm-hmm. He is a senator.
He's the one who was like, we welcome all these new Texas babies. So... they're not going to say, no, don't let them.
I wonder if Planned Parenthood has ever thought about, or if you've asked them, hey, is this an issue of, I mean, sort of a campaign for them and changing their sort of identity? If they were, you know, maybe change their name or somehow associated with...
put them,
you know,
in the Federal Witness Protection Program or something?
Separate that association with abortion, because that's not all that they do.
Well, they tried to do that, and most of the Planned Parenthood
facilities...
It is legally
separated.
Most of the Planned Parenthood facilities around the state don't have anything to do with abortion, and when they do, they've separated those things, because an earlier state law defunded all of the Planned Parenthoods that had an abortion facility. So that's already been separated as a legal matter, but they've clearly got this name association problem, and it's clearly, as long as it's an applause line in a Republican primary, here or anywhere else, it's a problem for that organization.
And Planned Parenthood is very, they're very committed to saying that, you know, we are here to provide safe, legal abortions. And if they don't do it, you know, they're concerned about where women are going to go.
I mean, there are plenty of people out there that are totally opposed to those.
Right.
You know?
Right. And those are the people in power right now.
Right. Well, here at the Tribune's Tribcast, we are...
Where are we?
I don't know. Well, we're in a closet, a dark closet here recording this thing. Right. But we are very committed to providing safe and legal pathways, to providing us questions and comments through email.
How do your transitions are just awful.
and you get to answer all of them.
So if you want to do that, which no one really opposes, I mean, it's politically neutral. It's tribcast@texastribune.org. In the meantime, on behalf of Ross, Brandy, Ton, and our producer, Todd, this is Reeve. Thanks for listening.
Talk about punch you in the balls.